Okay, we're part four, still focusing on what we're going through. Just wanted to just remind everyone before I forget, next week, it will be the last one, because I'm actually the following week going overseas for a few weeks. So I'm actually going overseas the following Thursday, but too early to do the shiur before I leave, so... But what I'm going to do is actually for while I'm away and also during the summer, just so we keep connected, I'm going to start a weekly, just 10-15 minutes sort of personal growth idea. I'll send all the details out so you can subscribe to the WhatsApp if you're not on it already, and we'll do that. Okay. Just before I get into what I want to do today, which I'll explain in a minute. Just want to pick up from something from last week where someone asked me a question and I wanted to sort of just address it. Actually wasn't here because I shared a similar idea afterwards somewhere else and someone sent me an email. So we talked about moral clarity last week. We talked about that in Judaism we have something called absolute morality, which is from God, transcendent source, a source outside of human existence. So that's not relative and doesn't depend on our feelings and change of society and change of values and things like that. And therefore, it's communicated from God through the Torah in Jewish experience. And therefore, it often comes with nuanced thinking, and also it requires us sometimes to hold two things together, which we explained last week at length, that some of the main moral values in Judaism is love of life, love of peace, love in general, and at the same time, there's a morality in war when we need it. And we talked about how Yaakov was distressed. He was going to fight the war, but he was distressed about having to do it. And that's how we navigate it. So we navigate it by holding two things at once in our minds where our foundation is life, our foundation is love of life, but we do things that we don't enjoy. So war is something which is moral. It's a just war and a moral war, even if it means we have to kill, but it's not something we enjoy. It's not something we celebrate. And those two things come together. So I got an email about something in last week's parsha, and I just wanted to share with you, and I'll tell you what I answered it. Someone said, if that's the case, if our morality is absolute, then last week we have an interesting story in the Chumash where God decided to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, right? Sodom and Gomorrah, they were extremely evil, and the evilness, so to speak, had just come to a point where it was just humongous, and therefore God decided to destroy those cities. He let Abraham into the plan. And we have this fascinating piece in Vayera where Abraham protests and he argues with God. He says, maybe there's some good people there, you can save the city, and like, is it all bad, and all this kind of stuff, right? And he has quite a robust argument with God, it seems. And God let him talk, and he said, maybe there's 50 righteous people, maybe there's 40, maybe there's 10. Anyway, eventually there was nothing, and Abraham accepted, and he went away. So the question put to me was, if morality is absolute, and if God decides he's going to destroy his dome, so why argue with him? If it's an absolute thing, and we're just going to accept it from where it comes, and because it's moral, and moral doesn't mean something we understand, it doesn't mean something we accept, or something we celebrate necessarily, but it's moral. If God says it's moral, it's moral. So what's the argument, right? So I actually thought that's the other way around. In other words, I think actually what it did is it really enhanced the idea we were talking about last week. In fact, that story creates a model for us, the exact model I was discussing last week, which is that's part of the dilemma. Our job is to challenge destruction, which Abraham did, because we love life. When we see destruction happening, we have to challenge it, question it, which is exactly what Abraham did. He did it quite strongly. But yet, when he understood from God that God said, no, it's the moral thing right now is to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, for whatever reason, that's not the discussion now. He accepted it. Because both things can happen together. Because we have to, we don't question or we don't challenge something good, something that's kind and compassionate and all that. That's part of what we like doing. But when something involves destruction, we have to challenge it, which is exactly what Abraham did. But at the same time, the challenge was still there. He still felt that he wanted to protect Sodom in a way. But yet God said it was the moral thing to do to destroy it, so therefore he accepted that. And in fact, the Torah tells us an interesting thing. The Torah tells us that the next day, because we learned that Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were the ones to institute the idea of prayer three times a day. Abraham made Shacharit, Yitzchak made Mincha in this week's parsha, and Yaakov made Ma'ariv. So the next day it says, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. Avraham got up early in the morning, which the Talmud understands and interprets to mean that he prayed. B'makom Asher Amad Sham, he did it at the exact place where he argued with God the day before. And that's what he made. Otherwise, he came back to the place, not to argue this time, but to pray to God. My job was to challenge destruction. You said we have to destroy it. I still don't like destruction, but because it's an absolute morality, I accept it. I'm praying to you. And on the prayers at the same place, and I know you'll still listen to my prayers, and prayer still helps, and so on and so forth. So I think it's actually an example of what we were talking about last week, how those two things need to come together and can coexist in the experience of nuanced thinking and moral thinking. Okay, so today, I want something a little bit different, just a warning. Different style, that's what I say. First of all, I'm going to share with you, I want to share with you something that I learned this week, which I just think is fascinating in context of what's happening now. Not necessarily to do with personal growth and everything, but it's just a fascinating idea. And then I want to do what we've been doing and learn, you know, sort of manage our own feelings and emotions. But today I'm going to do it a little bit differently, only because what I'm going to say might sound a little political. And I'm prefacing that because I'm obsessed normally about not being political. I know people know I've been here, that we're not political. We never talk, never take sides. No one ever knows. A lot of times when there's a political thing even happening in Australia, no one in Binah would actually know what I even think. Because my job is not to be political. I have a job, I have a mission. My mission is to teach and to inspire. And sometimes there's two sides of a debate. And Binah's, that's the way I feel. I saw this past Rosh Hashanah, someone on a website, it's a cute thing, about a congregant rabbi, writing to the rabbi about what he doesn't want to hear in the sermon that's coming Rosh Hashanah. He says, please, Rabbi, I love your sermons, I'm looking forward to them, but please don't. And he lists about 10 things. And one of them is, please don't talk politics. Please don't talk politics. Politics are for the politicians, are for the political analysts. So I don't do that. However, I am going to do a little bit today, because number one, sometimes when it comes basic morality and ethical living, just sometimes it's important to speak up only so we are confident within ourselves. And especially to what's going on right now with Israel and the war and the struggle, we need to build, and I said this last week, we need to build confidence from within and not let ourselves despair or doubt ourselves by being bombarded with false narratives and false media messaging and all that kind of stuff. And the second reason I'm going to do it is because I want to actually learn a very big lesson from it. I think it's something that we need to understand in terms of our own approach, in terms of how we navigate this whole experience. And the topic is going to be around victim, not being a victim, and victimhood. But before we get there, as I said, I'm just going to digress a little bit and share with you something that I learned this week. Something fascinating in very early writings. And when I say early writings, I'm referring to the Zohar, which was written about the 4th century. I'm talking about Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, which is a great, famous collection of writings written about 11th century. The Rav Moshe Kadaviro, a Kabbalist, who was about 16th century. And the Maharal, the famous Maharal of Prague, who discusses this at length, I discovered this week. He was the great philosopher, the Kabbalist, lived in Prague. He lived also in the 16th century. And here's the context. Let me just give you the context so you understand it. We have a tradition in Jewish writings that throughout the Jewish experience, from when we left Egypt, right, and we became God's nation, that somehow along the way, for reasons we don't always understand, it was a little bit predestined that we would go through challenging times. And the way that challenging times is described is in the concept, the context of four galiyot, which means four exiles, right? The four exiles are referred to as Babel, the Babylonian exile, the Persian exile, which happened just after the Babylonian exile, the Greek exile, which happened actually during the Second Temple, but the Jews were under complete Greek, or actually was Syrian, but Syrian Greek culture rule, and weren't able to serve, weren't able to go into the temple. That's the prelude to the festival of Hanukkah, which is coming up in a few weeks. And then after the second temple was destroyed by the Romans, the Romans came from Esau, who's Esau is also known as Edom, and the exile that followed and all the trouble that we had through the last couple of thousand years is all referred to as Galut Edom, the exile of Edom, right? Edom is Esau. Now, fascinating enough, the Medrash tells us that this actually is hinted in the very, very beginning of the Torah with the hope and the destiny and the final destination. Because we read at the very beginning of the Torah that we started just a few weeks ago after Simchat Torah, that when God created the world, it says, V'ha'aretz, and the earth, Hayat Tohu V'avohu, was chaotic and empty, V'choshech al panei tohom, and darkness upon the depths. And then it says, V'ruach Elohim, the Spirit of God was hovering over the water. Because at that time, the earth was still submerged in water. And it's a fascinating medrash. The medrash says that those four negative expressions about what the world was, chaos, emptiness, darkness, and the sort of the abyss, the depths, are all referring to the four exiles. Tohu, he says, emptiness, chaos, refers to the exile of Babel, the Babylonian exile. Vohu, emptiness, refers to the Persian exile. Choshech, the darkness, and the Medrash goes into why each one is like that, but I'm not going to go into that now, but Choshech, darkness, is the Greek exile, and Panei Tohom, the depths of the abyss, refers to the Galut Edom, because it's a very, very long one, and it sort of, you can't even see the bottom of it, it's so long, right? And then it says, the Ruach Elohim Merachefet Al Pnei HaMayim, the Spirit of God was hovering over the water, Ze Rucho Shel Mashiach, that's the Spirit of Mashiach. In other words, to say that, yes, there will be these Galiot, there will be the exiles, there will be the tough times that the Jews have to go through, the various persecutions and anti-Semitism and so on and so forth, but the ultimate destination, we believe a foundation of Judaism, is that there will come a time where there will be complete peace, there will be eternal peace, there will be the coming of Mashiach, the rebuilding of the temple. And Jews have believed in that and sang Ani Mamin again and again throughout thousands of years. I think this is making a bit of... Let me just see if I can get rid of this noise. I don't know. Not sure if I did. Okay. All right, so that's the basic framework. Now... Then I've heard this before, but this I saw sort of a reference to something, and I sort of researched a little bit this week, just from my own knowledge. I just thought it was very fascinating. There's a fascinating thing that not everyone knows about. There's a fifth exile. Gosh. No. It's happening now, or has happened for the last... Yeah, no, this is the real abyss. Listen to this. What's the fifth exile? The fifth exile is Galut Yishmael. Yishmael exile. Listen. This is actually fascinating. I mean, it's sad, but it's fascinating. Because the writings tell us that Galut Yishmael is the last exile. And it's a very powerful one and dangerous one, which we're experiencing now. We've experienced it for the last number of decades, but it's, you know. And the question is, because all this, a lot of the stuff that happened throughout, up until the rebirth of the land of Israel, the state of Israel, was Galut Edom. It was very much to do with Edom. Edom is Rome. Edom is Christianity. I know nowadays the Christians are our good friends, but they weren't always, as you know. The Crusaders, the Spanish Inquisition, up until the Holocaust. And then that sort of switched, and then Ishmael took over, right? And the question is, why... This isn't the topic of today, by the way. I just thought I'd share with you because I think it's fascinating. The question is, why isn't it counted as one of the fifth, as one of the Galiot? Why do we say there's four exiles and then we have to discover someone in some sources that there's actually a fifth one? Why don't you just start off with five, right? And the Maharal of Prague says the following. That he says, because it's a very different exile. All the other exiles was an exile that could only happen when the Jews had no power. In other words, in fact, this goes back to a midrash that when Rivka was pregnant with Yaakov and Esav, she went to find out what's happening because there was two children there struggling and she was having problems. And they told her there's going to be two nations. And Kashizeh comes and fell. When the one is up, the other one will be down. When the other one is up, the other one... In other words, they don't coexist. The one can only power the other one when the other one is down. And so it's been throughout all the exiles. The Babylonian exile is when we lost our sovereignty. We lost the temple. We went into Babylonia. The Greek exile, the Persian exile was the same thing. and of course the Galut Edom. But says the Maharal, the Galut Yishmael is a stronger one. Galut Yishmael can exist even when the Jews are powerful. And then there's two fascinating things that are connected with this. He says, however, it is connected to one of the Galiot. It's connected to the Persian exile. You know what that is? Where's Persia today? Iran. He says, Galut Yishmael is connected to the Persian exile. And then he said, and then also the Zohar writes, and Rav Moshe Kadavira writes, he says that the Galut Yishmael will take place before Mashiach comes, when the Jews have a land. It's unbelievable. This is like 500 years ago.
Yeah.
Right? The good part is, I mean, that's the disturbing part. But the good part is, you see, the concept of this whole thing is it's a plan that we don't understand. It's a destiny we don't understand. We don't understand why the journey and the destiny of the Jewish people couldn't have been much smoother than it is. But what we do know is that this that did happen over the last thousands of years, God is in that plan. Why he does it, we don't know why. But he's with us. And in fact, the Talmud says very clearly, "B'chol tzaratam latzor," that when Jews go into Galut, when Jews are oppressed, God is there in the oppression. He's in pain together with us. It's the obvious question there, so why does he put it to an end? Okay, that's a theological question, which is for another discussion, and there's no really why. We don't know the answer why. Right? But he's there with us. The good part, I think, of this whole thing is that we've just experienced the unleashing and the real negative power of Galut Yishmael, and we just need to win this because we are taught in the scriptures that this is the last Galut. And after this, hopefully, we're coming to Mashiach. I just thought that was fascinating. I thought something that's written so many hundreds of years ago, very, very prophetic in a way. We always used to believe and hope and think that we had already fulfilled all the prophecies of war before Mashiach. Obviously, that wasn't the case, and hopefully, this is the last one. Okay.
So, what does it mean for us?
It means that it means oppression. It means that in the land that we have, and as Rav Moshe Kadavira says, and the Maharal explains, that although we have sovereignty and we have power, and yet there was still successful Galut, and that's an unbelievable, powerful Galut, which none of the other nations were able to do, but Yishmael is. He gives a whole explanation why that is, but for me, the comforting part of it is that we're almost there.
Yeah.
Please God. Okay. What I wanted to share with you today is the following. I wanted to share with you, sorry?
No, we just... Yeah. We don't know.
We have to believe every day. Every day it could happen. Miracles could happen. Miracles have happened. The miracles could happen. And let's hope it comes to a swift end, but not with the. I mean, we've already paid a very, very heavy price. But let's hope this is it and we can end this miraculously. Okay, what I wanted to share today, and I said it, you know, part of it will sound a little political, is based on a verse in Tehillim. And in verse Tehillim, there's a fascinating verse where King David says, and he says an expression where there's many different interpretations of what he means, but I'm going to give you one. And he says, "Me'oivai techakmeni." He says, sometimes from my enemies, I can become wise. And as the famous commentator, the Radak, says, that sometimes we have to look at the enemy to know what not to do and to know how we need to be higher and better in a different framework. So me'oivai techakmeni, we can actually become wise from our enemies. Why am I saying that? Because I've made the mistake that I'm sure many of you have made and looked at a lot of media stuff. Some people are doing better. I mean, I'm trying to cut down, but you know, it's difficult, as we know. But one of the narratives, one of the themes, right, that is coming out, many, many themes, and many terrible themes, but one of the themes that I've picked up that is coming out from all the nonsense, the pro-Hamas and the pro-Palestinian media and so on and so forth, one very strong theme is that concept of victimhood. Lack of responsibility, blaming everyone else. And it's really a campaign sort of almost to hold on to being a victim. I'm going to explain in a second what I mean. All right. which of course is the antithesis to the Jewish experience, the antithesis to what, to the Jewish approach, right? In Judaism, and we see this all the time, and there's so many examples, we're going to go through some in the middle, in a few minutes. In Judaism, we recognize evil, we fight evil, we call it out, but we never become defined by the evil, right? It's never, we learn from it, but as we see the experience of the Jewish nation throughout the years, throughout the generations, we never ever become defined by it, and we always make the best of a situation, and we grow. We take responsibility. We know what our mission is. We know what our focus is, and we develop, and we grow, and we emerge stronger physically and spiritually. So when I talk about the victim thing, you know, you hear a lot of nonsense in the video, on the media, right? The things that get repeated again and again. The problem with these things that get repeated again and again is because people start to believe them after a while, right? People talk about the occupation of 75 years, right? Now, I'm no historian, but we all know a little bit of facts, right? So, a bit of history. 5 times the Palestinians were offered a state. You know that? 5 times. 1936 with the Peel Commission. The Jews were offered 20% of the land of Israel. Because they decided, in the British Mandate, they decided that the solution was to divide the land, make a two-state solution, as they call it. And we were going to get, not a very fair, two-state, we were going to get 20% of Israel. The Jews agreed, did you know that?
In 36.
36, the Peel Commission, this was before 47. Then it all got derailed because of the war, but in 36, something called the Peel Commission, it was we were offered 20% of the land of Israel, and we agreed. Then everything off went the rails, then of course there was a lot of the other stuff that came in 1947, 1948, with the whole UN partition plan. We also didn't get a very fair peace, but we were offered only part of Israel, and we took it. Why? Because Jews know it's not perfect. It's not what we want. It's not what we pray for. It's not what should have happened. It's our ancestral land, the entire Israel's ancestral land. But this is what we're going to get, this is what we're going to get, and we're going to make it work, and they did. And of course, the Arabs didn't. The next day, they attacked us. A whole bunch of nations attacked us. And miraculously, we pulled through. We won with not a very big part of Israel. And we started to work. We started to farm. We turned deserts into blooming areas. We brought back Torah learning and all sorts of things. Right? Tough, very, very tough, but we did it. And then, of course, in 1967, we were going to be attacked, and we preempted that, thank God. And the miraculous Six-Day War, which the next day there was a suggestion of giving back some of that land already then. And then there was the famous Arab League conference where the three no's. No peace, no negotiation, and no recognition of Israel. Right? And then, of course, in 2000, with the Oslo Accords, Ehud Barak offered Yasser Arafat a tremendous amount of Israel. The whole Gaza and 94% of the West Bank. And he turned it down, and what followed was suicide bombing. 2008, Ehud Olmert offered even more than Barak, and they turned it down. So, and then we'll talk about 2005 in a minute, right? But it's just, because why? Because they didn't get exactly what they wanted, supposedly. Because there's some obsession of hanging on to a narrative of victimhood, of being the victim. I heard a crazy clip, I'm sure some of you saw it, the other day. Someone challenged one of the Hamas leaders, why... Don't you protect? Why don't you build shelters for the civilians? Why don't you protect them, right? And he answered that 75% of Gaza are refugees. It's the UN's responsibility. It's a real genius step. I mean, you got to come up with such a chap. You got to be like smart, right? Unbelievable. They took it over. They're the governing body there, but it's not our responsibility. It's actually the UN's because they're refugees. Which country is a refugee after three generations? Right.
But there's no country called Palestine.
Okay, that's a separate issue. I'm not going to get that political. But I said I only get a little bit political. Okay. When the state of Israel was established, there were 800,000 refugees coming from Jewish refugees, who were expelled, right? From a whole bunch of the Arab countries. Those 800,000 refugees came to Israel. They weren't in a refugee camp for 5 minutes. Maybe for 5 minutes, right? They got to it, they started being part of Israel, they started growing the land, they started developing, working and farming, contributing to what is today an amazing country. Right? That concept of being a victim is just, okay, it's an unbelievable theme and no one's talking about it. I mean, people are talking about it, but no one wants to agree to it, right? And then that results, of course, into all the stuff that we control, the water, we control the electricity, we control this. And then the big lie, of course, is it's a blockade. Since it's been a blockade. In 2005, whether you agree with what happened or not, people didn't agree. But the facts are that in 2005, Ariel Sharon gave Gaza back to the Palestinians. He said, here, do it. Left the greenhouses there, left the synagogue, left everything there. Right? They had an amazing opportunity. An amazing opportunity to actually build a country. And there was no siege then. The siege was when they started firing rockets, of course, right? But everything was this. But it just, no, we want to be the oppressed.
The bolt tunnels.
Bolt tunnels instead, exactly. I mean, it's a crazy thing. We talk about refugee camps. Well, it's not refugee camps, it's not like tents and stuff. It's a built-up city, but it's just the most crazy thing. Now, of course, no one is perfect. Of course, Israel made mistakes along the way. Everyone makes mistakes. No country in the world is perfect. But this refugee camp concept, what do you mean, after three generations?
And how does the world not see
it? I don't know. To me, it's very different.
We can see it.
Now, we don't see it because like this. And this is what I wanted to really get to. My point wasn't just to vent. No, but I mean, first of all, it's important for us to know this stuff. It's important for us to know we know all this rubbish on television and on social media. We need to know what the truth is, okay? But the truth is, the reason that we're so allergic to it is for a different reason. Because part of the Jewish DNA, which is very counter to actually what is happening across the world, it's not just in Gaza, what's that, right? We become a very victim society in general nowadays, right? Victimhood, we've talked about this a lot. Being a victim evolves into becoming narcissistic. We had a whole series of narcissism, if you remember correctly, right? Which is the antithesis of Jewish thinking, because in Jewish thinking, we never give in to victimhood. Never. We never have, and we never will. Because being a victim in Jewish experience is just not a thing. It's not in our DNA, it's not in our dictionary, right? As I said before, we fight evil, but we never become a victim to evil. And we never define ourselves by the persecution. Now, we've given these examples before, but let me just run through them. If we were victims, we wouldn't have Jewish learning today. I've shared this with you before that people are not always aware of it, but the Talmud, which we have today, called the Talmud Bavli, the Babylonian Talmud, we call it, and the Jerusalem Talmud, there's two Talmuds, right? Which is the seat and the conglomeration and the source of all Jewish learning today. And Jewish learning is infinite and vast and deep and amazingly sophisticated, right? All Jewish learning today is based on this thing called the Talmud. You know when the Talmud was authored and written? In the time of extreme persecution. Rabbi Akiva was one of the greatest Talmudists, greatest rabbis in the Talmud. Was tortured to death at the end of his life because he insisted on continuing to study Torah, even in public, when it was prohibited by the Romans. The extreme persecution that was happening then under Roman rule was every reason to despair. Every reason. Every reason to play victim, every reason to say, well, we can't do anything, we can't develop, we can't blossom, we can't grow, we can't contribute because we're being persecuted. What do they do instead? They wrote and authored a Talmud. I don't know how much if you can really appreciate what a Talmud is, you need to study Talmud a bit to know, but it's incredible. When I was in Yeshiva, we studied Talmud for 7 hours a day. Right? It was just scratching the surface. When was it all done? Under extreme persecution. When the Jews were in France around the time of the Crusaders, 24 truckloads of manuscripts of commentary on the Talmud and Talmud. There was no printing press in those days, it was burnt. There was almost under threat of the Talmud being forgotten. And they refused to see, there was no giving up. They rewrote them and they had some manuscripts left over and they copied them and it flourished. And in France at that time, gave birth to some of the greatest sages. Rashi, the Tosfot, Rashi's grandchildren. Right? I think I've shared this to you before, but the Talmud says a fascinating thing about Rabbi Akiva, just to go back to Rabbi Akiva. You know, there's in the Torah we have two parts called the written Torah and the oral Torah. Right? Now, the written Torah in its original form is like in the Torah scroll. If you open it up, there's no vowels, it's just words, right? It's words, and also some of the words, when they're written in the Torah, not when they're printed in a book, they have what's called tagin, little crowns on them. Right? Many of the letters, like the Shin, the Zayin, the Chet, and so on. They have like these little crowns. And it says Rabbi Akiva was so great that he knew how to interpret these crowns. Each crown means something different. Each crown is hiding a wealth of Jewish law and Jewish thinking and Jewish academia. And it says Rabbi Akiva, Haya Doresh, Rabbi Akiva used to interpret Tilei Tilim Shalachas, mountains of Jewish knowledge, I'll call Kotz V'Kotz on every crown. But here the Talmud doesn't call it, the crowns are normally called Tagin. A tag is like a crown, right? Over here it calls it something different. It calls it Kotz, which actually means a thorn, because they're shaped like thorns a little bit, right? And the commentaries say, why does the Talmud use that expression? What do you mean, he used to interpret mountains of Jewish knowledge on every thorn? Why doesn't he call it by its normal name? And once the most beautiful idea that the Kotz thorn is a hurt, is a thing that pricks, it inflicts pain. And what the Talmud is really telling us is Rabbi Akiva had this amazing ability, not just about understanding the Torah and understanding how to interpret the crowns on the letters, but Rabbi Akiva was able to build Jewishness, was able to build Jewish knowledge and Jewish thinking and Jewish academia, even when they were being thorned. I'll call Kotz V'Kotz, every prick, every thorn, every pain inflicted on the Jewish people, the response was more light, more learning, more Jewishness, not victimhood. And of course, in more recent times, as we said before, Israel today, from 1948, was built with tremendous pain and threat, and we emerged into the most amazing country. And the 800,000 refugees that came from Arab countries didn't give up, didn't despair. Being a victim wasn't there. And just generally, the collective Jewish experience after the Holocaust was unbelievable. And every time in Jewish history we've been persecuted, we've rebuilt and rebounded. Because being a victim it's not in our DNA. I've shared with you not just in Jewish learning, in so many other areas, right? In so many other areas, I've shared with you this story before, but it's one of my favorites. Like one of my great Hasidic rabbi heroes after the Holocaust is the Kloisenberger Rebbe. I'm sure I've shared this before. The Kloisenberger Rebbe was one of the most amazing Jews, a big, big Torah scholar. And he was a big rabbi before the war. A big rabbi, he had a wife and 11 children, and they all died. His wife and all 11 children. And he had every reason to give up and say, you know, I'll just go into my corner, do my thing, and live out my days. He refused to do that. He went to America first, and he built a Hasidic court, then he loved Israel. He went to Israel, and he built a whole Sinatania today. It's a huge Hasidic thing. And he built not only Torah centers, he had made a promise in the Holocaust that if he survives, he's gonna build a hospital. That's I think it's called the Leonardo Hospital in Natanya, I think it is, right? And the story goes, at the end, he moved permanently to Israel, but in the beginning, he was going back and forth, America and Israel, because he had two communities there. And the story goes that when the first baby was born in the maternity ward in the Leonardo Hospital, he was overseas. And they called him so he can hear the baby cry. And when he heard the baby cry, he said, "That's my revenge." Right, we don't take revenge to become in a victim way. We take revenge by bringing more light. That's how we fight back, right? Succeeding. But as I said,
succeeding.
Yeah, exactly. And just generally, I mean, economy, academia, colleges, everything in Israel is just amazing. What it's all from the ashes, because that's our response. That's the Jewish response. Now I bring this out so strongly, and I feel so strongly about it because I think it's a very relevant topic generally today. And I'm going to share with you something that I mentioned before, but I want to share with you a video that I saw. He's not my favorite guy at all. In fact, he wasn't my favorite guy before this even, but Gabor Mate made a video this week, or last, a couple of weeks ago. Right? Gabor Mate is terrible. I'm sorry. He just is. He's so anti-Israel, it's just shocking. And I want to bring out a point. Gabor Mate. I know he's a big hero today in the area of trauma. And he says a lot of, he has some amazing books. I have some of them. And he's got a lot to offer on the whole area of trauma and healing from trauma and so on and so forth. When we did the series on trauma, some of you remember actually mentioned him. because I didn't agree with some of the stuff that he says on trauma from a Jewish point of view, and I'll tell you why. And actually, it all fits now that I think about it.
Yeah.
It all fits for the following reason. So he made a video, and I'm going to call it out because it needs to be called out. He's such a hero, and he got the problem with him is, I mean, there are a couple of Jews like that, but
yeah.
But he's got an amazing following because of his work that he does in the mental health field. And among many things, he said that, of course, it's impossible to justify what Hamas did on October the 7th, but it's explainable. Okay? That's a shocking thing to say. It's like what that Secretary General said, that it happened in a vacuum, right? And the truth is that it fits into his whole approach to trauma. You remember when I did the series on trauma, and I think it's just important to understand how we need to approach things today. Now, trauma is a real thing. And there's post-traumatic stress disorder, and there's a lot of healing that needs when people go through real trauma, and so on. There's intergenerational trauma. All these things are true. But what's also true is the power of resilience. So if you remember, we did the series on trauma. I brought two bodies of work. One was from him, and the other one was from a guy called George Bannon. Bannon or something. Who did research on the concept of resilience, right? And that was based on the whole study they did after 9/11, where they set up all these trauma centers in New York, and they thought there would be an influx, and it would be overflooded, and there would be years of post-traumatic stress disorder, and it didn't happen. It did happen for some people. It happened short-term right after, but long-term it didn't happen. Why? Because there was a lot of research done afterwards on the whole concept of resilience, and they found that most people are actually resilient. And although trauma is a real thing and needs to be dealt with when it affects people, and post-traumatic stress disorder is a real thing and needs healing, but actually the majority of people have an unbelievable resilient spirit, and most people actually recover and don't experience post-traumatic stress disorder. And he goes through the point of the book is he goes through the whole research and comes up with a whole theory of what it is that people who aren't naturally resilient, of how they can nurture and how they can learn resilience through various different mediums, right? Gavramate has a whole different approach. For him, everyone's traumatized. Right? If you were 6 months old and your mother didn't look at you for 10 minutes, it's separation, it's disconnection, it's trauma. Trauma for life. Which I've never agreed with, but now I understand where it's coming from. It's a whole thinking. We've just got to take the person who looks like the victim, and that's the whole focus. And we need to keep people victims because everyone's a victim. Because everyone has trauma, everyone's traumatized, everyone's this. Yeah, of course, then you've got to try and... Of course, it talks about resilience. Also, and going to the process of healing, but the emphasis becomes on the trauma, not on the healing, not on the resilience. So both things are true. Resilience is true, trauma is true, but not everyone is traumatized. And not everyone should put, because nowadays, people, I mean, it's unbelievable. Like in colleges, as soon as you say something today that people don't like, they need a safe room, safe space. I'm not talking about a bomb shelter from rockets. I'm talking about they need somewhere to go. They feel safe because someone said something to them that wasn't exactly in line with what they think and what they feel, right? It's unbelievable. We're building a generation of victims. You know, it's like I've done a lot of research of this parenting stuff also. There's a new sort of wave of parenting. Also goes like this. I don't know about you, but my 4-year-old, when I had a 4-year-old, that is, a while ago, right? My 4-year-old went over to his sister or his brother, 2 years old, and hit them. I didn't call him and say, "What's bothering you?"
Yeah.
I didn't do that. Why are you laughing? They do that today. That's the new method.
Oh, how are you feeling? Yes. What's your problem?
Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't do that at all, right? Because if a kid is... By the way, it's pretty normal for a 4-year-old to go hit a 2-year-old. But it's also normal for a parent to pull them aside and say, "Don't do that. That is not acceptable. Finished. End of story." Now, of course, some children are born with some tendencies which are a little bit over the top, and sometimes they do have emotional problems, sometimes there has been experiences in the home where there's been toxicity or instability or whatever the case is. And of course, yes, at some point you need to set the child down and say, if it's excessive and it continues and nothing's helping, you need to explore what's going on and what's behind it. I'm all for that. Of course you have to do that. But like there's good and there's evil. I mean, hitting a child is wrong. And we are born, by the way, naturally without brains. That's what happens. I mean, underdeveloped brains at least, right? That's what the Torah tells us. We only develop them a little bit older, 13, 12, 20, whatever the case is, right? Different ages that the Torah gives us for intellectual maturity. But little kids don't have intellectual maturity, and therefore they do things that are stupid. They do things that are instinctive and impulsive. And it's our job as parents and as society, in schools it's the same thing. I heard a panel from a guy who I disagree with most of the time, but he's considered quite a big educator in the Jewish community in New York. And now again, I'm all for not being harsh with children, and of course everything must come from love. It's all true. But don't turn them into victims. I heard he spoke about schools, how schools have to run. He obviously never walked into a classroom, but he's a psychologist, but you know, not always they understand what's going on the ground. So he said that when a child comes late, he was talking about a typical scenario, a child walks in very late to class, a teenager, or he does something wrong. So he said, you know, normally you discipline them. I mean, at some level, obviously it needs to be done. I'm not into harsh discipline and negative discipline, obviously. You mustn't put children down. We must show them a lot of positivity and love. That's all true. But bad behavior needs to be called out, and there needs to be some level of assertiveness, right? So he said, no, what you should do is you should put a note on his desk. If you're disturbing the class, the principal wants to see you, and the principal should ask him, sit him down and ask him, what's bothering you today? And he says, if it continues and it happens 2-3 times, the principal should prepare a Danish and a drink for this child. Like the show, I mean, just like, this is the stuff that's going on today, right? I know, you think it's, I'm not making this up, I promise you. Donna never did that, I'm sure. What's that? But it's all essentially the same thing. And that's why I'm bringing this up today. Because not just about collectively as a nation not being a victim and calling out the terrible narrative that's going on maintaining victimhood and therefore giving birth to all these lies that are happening on a political level. I'm talking about even what we do ourselves, right? Because again, trauma is true, resilience is true, but where's our focus? As Jews, our focus is light. Our focus is positivity. Our focus is resilience. We don't give in. Again, that doesn't mean we ignore. Being in denial is not a good thing. Because you've got to, even within ourselves, if we have trauma, if we have negative emotions, we have to recognize it. We have to be in touch with it and deal with it, but not be defined by it. And today we are in a society where we are being defined by this. It's not only about the Israel conflict. It's also about just general in life. It's very, very much. And that's why there's now research, which we did a while ago, coming out from, you know, Jane Twenge and Keith Campbell about the epidemic of narcissism. Because that's what happens. When you define yourself as a victim and you give in to every pain and every sort of problem without fighting back and being strong and learning to cope and learning to emerge stronger like Rabbi Akiva, when there's a thorn, you actually become stronger, not weaker. One great parenting person that I really like talks about the importance of teaching children, what does she call it? I forgot now. Pain tolerance or something. In other words, yes, not everything in life is comfortable. That's how it works. Right? And you gotta work with it. I'm talking about even small things. So we have to learn that. We mustn't do that. We're not a Jew. That's a very, very bad thing.
Is it soft parenting?
Sorry? Yeah, like parenting. Yeah.
Soft parenting.
All this stuff. It's all a bunch of, anyways. I mean, they all have good things in it, but it's. And all comes with, by the way, all comes with that. All our parents didn't know what they were doing. And the previous generations got it all wrong. Like the arrogance of it is like unbelievable. Anyway, but I want to bring up also an important point, which I think is very relevant now in terms of going back to the collective issue which is happening, right? In this current crisis, in this current struggle that we're going through, when we see all this stuff, and we see the anti-Semitism, which is real, the rise of anti-Semitism is real, and we see the narratives, and we see the unexpected people who we didn't expect would talk the way they do, and we see this rise of slogans which people call peaceful protests, which are really called for genocide, right? When you say from the river to the sea, it's a call for genocide, right? That's all true. But what we have to be careful is not to become a victim to that. Not to become a victim to that. In other words, what I mean to say is that shouldn't be our obsession, right? Because I pick up a little bit that people are doing that a bit, and that's not what we should be doing. In other words, our whole, we have to call out evil, we have to call out anti-Semitism, we have to fight anti-Semitism, we have to engage in advocacy. Those that do it well should do it more. But it shouldn't become our obsession, because when it becomes our obsession, we're actually doing the same thing. We're defining ourselves by anti-Semitism. And we should never do that. Jews have suffered a huge dose of persecution, but we've never to date ever defined ourselves by that persecution. We've never defined ourselves by anti-Semitism. Because when you define yourself by anti-Semitism or persecution, that's an opening to sink into despair. And to sink into anger. And to sink into hate. Just have to look at what's happening on the other side. That's exactly what happened. When you let yourself become a victim, you let yourself become hateful, angry, despair, and all the other negative emotions that comes with it. Right? So it's a fine line, because we shouldn't ignore it. It's real, and we should recognize it, fight it, identify it, call it out, but never become victim to it. You know, we learn this from all the way going back to our history. We learn it from our patriarch Jacob. Jacob lived a very persecuted life. He had big tzaras from his brother Esav, and he had much more than Abraham and Isaac, by the way. Right? He lived a very, very tough life. He only lost 17 years in Egypt. We're okay. But otherwise, it was really rough going the whole time. One of those rough patches was when he went to Laban, who became his father-in-law, who drove him crazy for 20 years. Threatened him. Persecuted him. What did Yaakov do? He built a whole family. Am Yisrael was born in Laban's house. Do you know that? 11 of the 12 tribes were born in Laban's house. Binyamin was the only one who was born in Israel when he came back. That's what he did. He built a family. When it was time to go, it was time to go. The rabbis tell us, what do you do at night? He would pray to God. He would put his faith in God. He would refuse to give up. He refused to define himself by that persecution. When he came back, and he was about to greet his brother Esav, who was still hating him till today, still hates him, right? Haven't gone away. Just now it's shifted a bit to Ishmael. Can I tell a story about it, as we said before? But when he came back, before he met his brother Esav, there's a famous story in Chumash, where he was crossing a river stream, and he put his family, and he went back to get something, and he was accosted by an angel. Right? Who was an angel? Our rabbis tell us, we mentioned it 2 weeks ago. The angel was the angel of Esav, because every nation has an angel, even the bad nations. And this was the angel, the Sar, the officer of Esav. And he wrestled with him the entire night. He wrestled with him, right? Listen to what happens at the end. Yaakov wouldn't give up. He kept wrestling with him. He said to bless me. He said that 2 weeks ago. He said to bless me. He said he wants to become stronger from it. And what happened at the end? What was the outcome? The outcome was Yaakov was injured. What does Yaakov do? He keeps going. But what also happened was that at the end of the night, Yaakov got a new name. His name was Yisrael, right? And in fact, we are called B'nai Yisrael for that reason, right? Yaakov is a name, Yisrael is a name. Why? Because Yisrael comes to the word, the verse says that he was called Yisrael because Kisarita im Elokim, because he wrestled the angel and he came out strong. Came out resilient. And then what happened at the end of the night was the sun came out, as the sun will come out, please God, very soon, figuratively speaking, and healed him. And he became strong. And he built the nation. Because even when he was fighting him, he was really Israel. You see, the difference between Yaakov and Israel is, the word Yaakov comes from being a heel. It's when we're trodden on, when we're being stamped upon, right? But that's not who we are. That's what happens to us. Sometimes we are Yaakov, but who are we really? Who was Yaakov even when he was being wrestled? What name did he get? He was really Israel. He was Sarkel. It's also Israel. Sarkel, officer of God, a prominent person. Right? Because sometimes we go through the experiences of Yaakov, but it's not who we really are. Who we really are is Yaakov. Is Israel, not Yaakov. In fact, the Talmud has a very beautiful thing, even on a spiritual level, it works like this. We never become defined not by outside persecution and not even by inner, internal spiritual failure. The Talmud has a beautiful expression. The Talmud says, you know, the person, if they transgress, if they do things, wrong things, they can always do tshuva, they can always return and reconnect with God. And the Talmud has this beautiful expression which says that Israel afal pi shachata Yisrael hu. That a Jew, even when he sins, he's still a Jew. But look at the wording. It doesn't say he's still Yaakov. He's not such a good guy, but you know, he's still something. No. Israel, a Jew, even if he sins and transgresses terribly, Who is he really? Israel. He's still a Israel. That's the true definition. Yeah, we go through patches, that's true. Patches of persecution, patches of spiritual failure, patches of lots of negative things, but that's not who we are. Because we never become defined by it. So I think that's a really important thing that we need to fight back, but we need to fight back the way we fight back. Especially us sitting here, distant from the front lines. Of course, we need to do what we need to do. Yaakov was going to fight Esav. If he needed to, we'd make a war. And that's what needs to happen. We spoke about this last week. The war is moral, it's just, and we have to be absolutely confident that it's completely the right thing to do. And those who are doing it with amazing faith and amazing strength, and just it's beyond. It's unbelievable. But as a nation, what we need to do is, and when we see all this nonsense rising, we need to recognize it but never become defined by it. We said last week, it's not because then we become a victim and we start hating and becoming angry. That's not who we are. We have to fight back, but fight back with good. Fight back with another prayer. Fight back with another mitzvah. Fight back with inspiring other people. Fight back with light. That's what we do. We fight back with light. Because we're never victims. So that's why I said, I wanted to share this with you today, because what King David says, we have to learn from the enemy. Just look what happened to the enemy when they fell into victimhood over decades. There's very little to show for it, except for hate and anger, and aggression and violence. Jews have never done that, and we shouldn't do it now either. We should know what's going on. We should not be in denial, but we have to fight back with light and growth and become even stronger than before. Have a wonderful week.
Can I
Yeah, sure.
There's